sometimes busy, sometimes idle. In the context of data communications network, it's a highly inefficient way to utilize a long-distance connection. It would be dramatically more cost-effective, then, to send data in blocks and allocate bandwidth in such a way that different messages could share the line. A message would be divided into specific blocks, which would then be sent out individually over the network through multiple locations and reassembled at their destination. Because there were multiple paths over which the different blocks could be transmitted, they could arrive out of sequence, which meant that once a complete message had arrived, however helter-skelter, it needed to be reassembled in the proper order. Each block would therefore need to contain information identifying the part of the message to which it belonged. What Barron envisioned was a network of unmanned switches or nodes, standalone computers essentially, that routed messages by employing what he called a self-learning policy at each node, without need for a central and possibly vulnerable control point. He came up with a scheme for sending information back and forth that he called hot potato routing, which was essentially a rapid store and forward system working almost instantaneously, in contrast with the old posted and forward teletype procedure. In Barron's model, each switching node contained a routing table that behaved as a sort of transport coordinator or dispatcher. The routing table at each node reflected how many hops or links were required to reach every other node in the network. The table indicated the best routes to take and was constantly updated with information about neighboring nodes, distances, and delays, much like dispatchers or truck drivers who use their CB radios to keep one another informed of accidents, construction work, detours, and speed traps. The continuous updating of the tables is also known as adaptive or dynamic routing. As the term hot potato suggests, no sooner did a message block enter a node than it was tossed out the door again as quickly as possible. If the best outgoing path was busy, or blown to bits, the message block was automatically sent out over the next best route. If that link was busy or gone, it followed the next best route, and so forth. And if the choices ran out, the data could even be sent back to the node from which it originated. Barron, the inventor of the scheme, also became its chief lobbyist. He hoped to persuade AT&T of its advantages, but it wasn't easy. He found that convincing some of the communications people within RAND of the feasibility of his ideas was difficult enough. The concepts were entirely unheard of in traditional telecommunications circles. Eventually, he won his colleagues' support. But winning over AT&T management, who would be called upon if such a network were to be built, proved nearly impossible. Barron's first task was to show that the nation's long-distance communication system, consisting of almost nothing but AT&T lines, would fail in a Soviet first strike. Not only did AT&T officials refuse to believe this, but they also refused to let RAND use their long-distance circuit maps. RAND resorted to using a purloined set of AT&T long lines maps to analyze the telephone system's vulnerability. Vulnerability notwithstanding, the idea of slicing data into message blocks and sending each block out to find its own way through a matrix of phone lines struck AT&T staff members as totally preposterous. Their world was a place where communications were sent as a stream of signals down a pipe. Sending data in small parcels seemed just about as logical as sending oil down a pipeline one cupful at a time. AT&T's officials concluded that Barron didn't have the first notion of how the telephone system worked. Their attitude was that they knew everything and nobody outside the Bell system knew anything, Barron said. And somebody from the outside couldn't possibly understand or appreciate the complexity of the system. So here some idiot comes along and talks about something being very simple, who obviously does not understand how the system works. AT&T's answer was to educate. The company began a seminar series on telephony, held for a small group of outsiders, including Barron. The classes lasted for several weeks. It took 94 separate speakers to describe the entire system, since no single individual seemed to know more than a part of the system, Barron said. Probably their greatest disappointment was that after all this they said, "Now do you see why it can't work?" And I said, "No." With the exception of a few supporters at Bell Laboratories who understood digital technology, AT&T continued to resist the idea. The most outspoken skeptics were some of AT&T's most senior technical people. "After I heard the melodic refrain of bullshit often enough," Barron recalled, "I was motivated to go away and write a series of detailed memoranda papers, to show, for example, that algorithms were possible that allowed a short message to contain all the information it needed to find its own way through the network." With each objection answered, another was raised, and another piece of a report had to be written. By the time Barron had answered all of the concerns raised by the defense, communications, and computer science communities, nearly 4 years had passed and his volumes numbered 11. In spite of AT&T's intransigence, Barron believed he was engaged in what he called an honest disagreement with phone company officials. The folks at AT&T headquarters always chose to believe their actions were in the best interest of the network, which was, by their definition, the same as what was best for the country, he said. By 1965, 5 years after embarking on the project, Barron had the full support of RAND, and that August RAND sent a formal recommendation to the Air Force that a distributed switching network be built, first as a research and development program and later as a fully operational system. "The need for a survivable, flexible, user-to-user communication system is of overriding importance. We do not know of any comparable alternative system proposals to attain this capability, and we believe that the Air Force should move swiftly to implement the research and development program proposed herein." The Air Force agreed to it. Now the only people holding out were the AT&T officials. The Air Force told AT&T it would pay the phone company to build and maintain the network, but the phone company was not to be swayed. The Air Force, determined not to let the plan die on the drawing boards, decided that it should proceed without AT&T's cooperation. But the Pentagon decided to put the newly formed Defense Communications Agency, DCA, not the Air Force, in charge of building the network. Barron pictured nothing but trouble. The agency was run by a group of old-fashioned communications officers from each of the various services, with no experience in digital technology. To make matters worse, DCA's enthusiasm for the project was on a par with the response from AT&T. "So I told my friends in the Pentagon to abort this entire program, because they wouldn't get it right," Barron recalled. "It would have been a damn waste of government money and set things back. The DCA would screw it up and then no one else would be allowed to try, given the failed attempt on the books." Barron felt that it was better to wait until a competent organization came along. And with that, after 5 years of struggle, Paul Barron shifted his attention to other things. It was, in no small way, a visit back to the "Are we rich or are we poor?" question he had posed decades earlier to his parents, whose starkly contrasting answers helped him understand that most things in life are a matter of perspective. In London in the autumn of 1965, just after Barron halted work on his project, Donald Watts Davies, a 41-year-old physicist at the British National Physical Laboratory, NPL, wrote the first of several personal notes expounding on some ideas he was playing with for a new computer network much like Barron's. He sent his set of notes to a few interested people, but, certain he would encounter stiff resistance from the authorities in charge of the British Post Office's telephone service monopoly, mostly he kept his ideas to himself. Davies wanted time to validate his concepts. By the following spring, confident that his ideas were sound, he gave a public lecture in London describing the notion of sending short blocks of data, which he called packets, through a digital store and forward network. As the meeting was breaking up, a man from the audience approached Davies and said that he was from the Ministry of Defense. He told Davies about some remarkably similar work that had been circulated in the American defense community by a man named Paul Barron. Davies had never heard of Barron or his RAND studies. Donald Davies was the son of working-class parents. His father, a clerk at a coal mine in Wales, died the year after Donald and his twin sister were born. Their mother moved her young family to Portsmouth, a British naval port, where she went to work as a counter clerk in the post office. Donald experimented with radio at a young age and took an early interest in physics. He was not yet 14 the day his mother brought home a book, something an engineer had left behind at the post office, all about telephony. The technical volume described the logic and design of telephone switching systems and made hours of fascinating reading, Davies recalled years later. An exceptional student, Davies was offered scholarships to several universities. To celebrate its star student, his school declared a half-day holiday. "For a short time, I was the most popular boy in the school," he recalled. Davies chose the University of London's Imperial College, and by the time he was 23 had earned degrees in physics and mathematics. In 1947 he joined a team of scientists led by the mathematician Alan Turing at the National Physical Laboratory, and Davies played a leading part in building the fastest digital computer in England at the time, the Pilot Ace. In 1954 Davies won a fellowship to spend a year in the United States. Part of that year he was at MIT. He then returned to England, rose swiftly at the NPL, and in 1966, after describing his pioneering work on packet switching, he was appointed head of the Computer Science Division. The technical similarity between Davies and Barron's work was striking. Not only were their ideas roughly parallel in concept, but by coincidence they had even chosen the same packet size and data transmission rate. Independently, Davies also came up with a routing scheme that was adaptive, like Barron's, but different in detail. There was just one major difference in their approaches. The motivation that led Davies to conceive of a packet switching network had nothing to do with the military concerns that had driven Barron. Davies simply wanted to create a new public communications network. He wanted to exploit the technical strengths he saw in digital computers and switches, to bring about highly responsive, highly interactive computing over long distances. Such a network would have greater speed and efficiency than existing systems. Davies was concerned that circuit-switched networks were poorly matched to the requirements of interacting computers. The irregular, bursty characteristics of computer-generated data traffic did not fit well with the uniform channel capacity of the telephone system. Matching the network design to the new types of data traffic became his main motivation. Rather than conduct the kind of redundancy and reliability studies to which Barron had devoted so much time, Davies focused on working out the details of configuring the data blocks. He also foresaw the need to overcome differences in computer languages and machine operating procedures, differences in hardware and software, that would exist in a large public network. He envisioned the day when someone would sit down at one kind of computer and interact with a machine of a different kind somewhere else. To bridge the gap between the widely divergent computer systems of the era, he began outlining the features of an intermediary device, a new computer, that would serve as a translator, assembling and disassembling digital messages for the other machines. The idea of splitting messages into uniform data packets, each the length of one typical line of text, was something Davies hit upon after studying advanced time-sharing systems and how they allocated processing time to multiple users. On a trip to the United States in 1965, he had observed MIT's Project Mac time-sharing system. A few months later, the NPL had played host in London to a group from MIT, including Larry Roberts, for further discussions about time-sharing. it was in those meetings that the packet idea first struck Davies. Unlike AT&T's chilly reaction to Barron, the British telecommunications establishment embraced Davies' ideas. He was encouraged to seek funding for an experimental network at NPL. Time-sharing systems had already solved the nagging problem of slow turnaround time in batch processing by giving each user a slice of computer processing time. Several people could be running jobs at once without noticing any significant delay in their work. Analogously, in a digital communications network, a computer could slice messages into small pieces or packets, pour those into the electronic pipeline, and allow users to share the network's total capacity. Davies, like Barron, saw in the digital age the feasibility for a new kind of communications network. Davies' choice of the word packet was very deliberate. "I thought it was important to have a new word for one of the short pieces of data which traveled separately," he explained. "This would make it easier to talk about them." There were plenty of other possibilities: block, unit, section, segment, frame. "I hit on the word packet," he said, "in the sense of a small package." Before settling on the word, he asked two linguists from a research team in his lab to confirm that there were cognates in other languages. When they reported back that it was a good choice, he fixed on it. Packet switching. It was precise, economic, and very British. And it was far easier on the ear than Barron's distributed adaptive message block switching. Davies met Barron for the first time several years later. He told Barron that he had been thoroughly embarrassed to hear of Barron's work after he had finished his own, and then added, "Well, you may have got there first, but I got the name." In December 1966, when Larry Roberts arrived at the Pentagon, he knew Donald Davies from his trip to London the previous year, but didn't know about Davies' subsequent work in packet switching. And he had never heard the name Paul Barron. A few years earlier, Roberts had decided that computing was getting old and everything worth doing inside a computer had already been done. This had come to him as a revelation at a 1964 conference held in Homestead, Virginia, where Roberts, Licklider, and others stayed up until the small hours of the morning talking about the potential of computer networks. Roberts left the meeting resolved to begin work on communications between computers. His first opportunity came a year later when he oversaw one of the first real experiments in uniting disparate machines over long distances. In 1965, psychologist Tom Merrill, who had studied under Licklider and who was similarly entranced by computers, started a small time-sharing company, Computer Corporation of America, CCA. When Merrill's largest investor backed out at the last minute, Merrill cast about for some R&D work. He proposed to ARPA that he conduct a networking experiment tying Lincoln's TX2 computer to the SDC Q32 in Santa Monica. Merrill's company was so small, however, that ARPA recommended carrying out his experiment under the aegis of Lincoln Laboratory. Officials at Lincoln liked the idea and put Larry Roberts in charge of overseeing the project. The objective was clear. As Merrill argued in a letter to Roberts in 1965, computing had reached an unfortunate state of affairs. Time-sharing projects were proliferating, but there was no common ground for exchange of programs, personnel, experience, or ideas. His impression of the computer science community was of a number of essentially similar projects, each going off in its own direction with complete disregard for the others. Why waste resources? As far as it went, the TX2 experiment was ambitious. The link between the two computers was made using a special Western Union four-wire full duplex service. Full duplex provides simultaneous transmission in both directions between two points. To this, Merrill attached a crude form of modem, operating at 2,000 bits per second, which he called an automatic dialer. By directly linking the machines, Merrill got around the problem of incompatibilities between them. The idea was to connect the computers like a pair of Siamese twins, running programs in situ. Though not transferring files back and forth, the experiment did allow the machines to send messages to each other. Merrill set up a procedure for grouping characters into messages, sending them across the link, and checking to see if the messages arrived. If no acknowledgement followed, the message was retransmitted. Merrill referred to the set of procedures for sending information back and forth as a message protocol, prompting a colleague to inquire, "Why do you use that term? I thought it referred to diplomacy." In a 1966 report summarizing the initial results of the experiment, Merrill wrote that he could foresee no obstacle that a reasonable amount of diligence cannot be expected to overcome. Diligence notwithstanding, when Merrill and Roberts actually connected the two machines, the results were mixed. The connection itself worked as planned, but the reliability of the connection and the response time were, as Roberts would describe them several years later, just plain lousy. Bringing together two different computers was one thing, but the project for which Roberts had been pulled away from Lincoln to work at ARPA was another, much greater challenge. Interconnecting a matrix of machines, each with distinct characteristics, would be exceedingly complicated. To pull it off was probably going to require calling on every expert Roberts knew in every area of computing and communications. Fortunately, Roberts's circle of colleagues was wide. One of his best friends from Lincoln Laboratory, with whom he had worked on the TX-2, was Leonard Kleinrock, a smart and ambitious engineer who had attended MIT on a full scholarship. If anyone influenced Roberts in his earliest thinking about computer networks, it was Kleinrock. Kleinrock's dissertation, proposed as early as 1959, was an important theoretical work that described a series of analytical models of communication networks. And in 1961, while working with Roberts, Kleinrock had published a report at MIT that analyzed the problem of data flow in networks. Kleinrock had also worked on random routing procedures, and had some early thoughts on dividing messages into blocks for efficient use of communication channels. Now Kleinrock was at UCLA, and Roberts gave him an ARPA contract to set up the official Network Measurement Center there, a lab devoted to network performance testing. The friendship between Roberts and Kleinrock went well beyond the professional interests they shared. Brain teasers were one common interest. Money-making schemes were another. Each reinforced the other's openness to fiscal adventure. Those who thought Roberts was all work and no play had never seen him in action with his friends. Roberts and Kleinrock were inveterate casino gamblers. Roberts developed a high-low counting scheme for blackjack and taught it to Kleinrock. They never made it into the official rogues gallery of blacklisted card counters, but more than once they were spotted by casino detectives and asked to leave. And in another daring episode, Roberts and Kleinrock cooked up a plan to cash in on the physics of roulette. The idea was to predict, employing rudimentary laws of motion, just when the ball would fall off its trajectory. To do this, they needed to know the speed of the ball, which traveled in one direction, and the speed of the wheel, which traveled in the other. They decided to build a small machine that would make the predictions, but they needed a little data. So Roberts got a tape recorder, put a microphone in his hand, and made a cast that made it appear he had a broken wrist. The two sat down at the table, and Roberts placed his hand next to the wheel to record the sound of the passing ball, from which they could later extrapolate its speed. Kleinrock's job was to distract the pit boss by playing several rounds of roulette. "Everything was working fine except for one thing," Kleinrock said. "I started winning. It drew attention to me. The pit boss looks over and sees this guy with a broken arm with his hand near the roulette wheel, and he grabs Larry's arm and says, 'Let me see your arm.' Larry and I made fast tracks out of there." Roberts agreed with Taylor that fast response time for the network was critical, because a low message delay time was crucial to interactivity. Anyone who had used time-sharing systems that passed data over standard communications lines knew how sluggish they could be. Data traveled to and from the main computer at excruciatingly slow rates of a few hundred bits per second. Retrieving or sending even a small amount of information was a process that left plenty of time to pour yourself a cup of coffee, or even brew an entire pot, while the modem churned away. No one wanted a sluggish network. During an early meeting of the loose group of advisors Roberts had assembled, someone banged his fist on the table and said, "If this network can't give me a one-second response, it's no good." Optimistically, a half-second response time was written into the requirements. The second priority, of course, was reliability. If a network was to be effective, users needed complete confidence in its ability to send data back and forth without snafus. Another source of consternation was the question of how the network would be mapped out. Several people had proposed that the resource sharing be done on a single centralized computer, sitting in, say, Omaha, a popular place for long-distance telephone switches, because it lay at the nation's geographic center. If centralization made sense for a telephone network, why not for a computer network? Perhaps the network should use dedicated phone lines, a question that was still unresolved, which would help keep costs uniform. Barron had avoided a centralized system because that increased its vulnerability. Roberts, too, was opposed to a centralized approach, but decided to delay his final decision until he could bring up the topic with a large group. His chance came soon, at a meeting for ARPA's principal investigators in Ann Arbor, Michigan in early 1967. Taylor had called the meeting, and the principal item on the agenda was the networking experiment. Roberts laid out his initial plan. The idea, as he described it, was to connect all of the time-sharing computers to one another directly, over dial-up telephone lines. The networking functions would be handled by the host computers at each site. So, in other words, the hosts would do double duty, as both research computers and as communications routers. The idea was greeted with little enthusiasm. People from the proposed host sites foresaw no end of trouble. No one wanted to relinquish an unknown portion of valuable computing resources to administer a network about which they were hardly excited. Then there were dozens of idiosyncratic variations to cope with, not the least of which was the fact that each machine spoke a language substantially different from the others. It seemed nearly impossible to standardize around one set of protocols. The Ann Arbor meeting revealed the lack of enthusiasm, if not downright hostility, to Taylor and Roberts's proposal. Few ARPA principal investigators wanted to participate in the experiment. This attitude was especially pronounced among researchers from the East Coast universities, who saw no reason to link up with campuses in the West. They were like the upper-crust woman on Beacon Hill, who, when told that long-distance telephone service to Texas was available, echoed Thoreau's famous line, "But what would I possibly have to say to anyone in Texas?" Douglas Engelbart, a computer scientist at Stanford Research Institute, SRI, in 1967, remembered the meeting clearly. One of the first reactions was, "Oh, hell, here I've got this time-sharing computer, and my resources are scarce as it is." Another reaction was, "Why would I let my graduate students get sucked off into something like this?" Nevertheless, it quickly became clear just how serious Roberts was. First, he tried to allay the skepticism about resource sharing by pointing out that everyone had something of interest on his computer that others might want. "I remember one guy turning to the other and saying, 'What have you got on your computer that I could use?'" Engelbart recalled, and the other guy replied, "Well, don't you read my reports?" No one was taken with the idea. People were thinking, "Why would I need anyone else's computer when I've got everything right here?" recalled John Postel, then a graduate student at UCLA. "What would they have that I want, and what would I have that I want anyone else to look at?" an even more difficult problem lay in overcoming the communications barriers between disparate computers. How could anyone program the TX-2, for instance, to talk to the Sigma-7 at UCLA, or the computer at SRI? The machines, their operating systems, their programming languages were all different, and heaven only knew what other incongruities divided them. Just before the meeting ended, Wes Clark passed a note up to Roberts. It read, "You've got the network inside out." Roberts was intrigued, and he wanted to hear more. However, the meeting was breaking up, and people were already leaving. Roberts, Taylor, and a few others huddled around Clark afterward, and a small group decided to continue the discussion during the ride back to the airport. In the car, Clark sketched out his idea. Leave the host computers out of it as much as possible, and instead insert a small computer between each host computer and the network of transmission lines. This was, by coincidence, precisely what Davies had concluded separately in England. The way Clark explained it, the solution was obvious. A sub-network, with small, identical nodes, all interconnected. The idea solved several problems. It placed far fewer demands on all the host computers and correspondingly fewer demands on the people in charge of them. The smaller computers composing this inner network would all speak the same language, of course, and they, not the host computers, would be in charge of all the routing. Furthermore, the host computers would have to adjust their language just once to speak to the subnet. Not only did Clark's idea make good sense technically, it was an administrative solution as well. ARPA could have the entire network under its direct control and not worry much about the characteristics of each host. Moreover, providing each site with its own identical computer would lend uniformity to the experiment. The most curious thing about the idea was that Clark thought it up. He hadn't been paying much attention to the proceedings in Ann Arbor. In fact, he was a bit bored by it all. He had already told Roberts in no uncertain terms that he had no desire to put his computer at Washington University in St. Louis on the network. Clark was not friendly toward time-sharing, or even resource-sharing. He had been working on computers designed for individual use, and saw no particular reason to share his facility with people on a network. But when he heard the discord over how the ARPA experiment should be deployed, he couldn't help but hazard a suggestion. Perhaps it was Clark's antipathy toward timesharing that enabled him to think of this. By assigning the task of routing to the host computers, Roberts and others were essentially adding another timesharing function. Clark's idea was to spare the hosts that extra burden and build a network of identical, non-shared computers dedicated to routing. During the ride to the airport, the discussion turned lively. Wouldn't an entire sub-network composed of individual computers be prohibitively expensive and defeat the original goal of saving money? And who, Roberts wanted to know, did Wes Clark think could build such a thing? "There's only one person in the country who can do that," Clark responded. "Frank Hart." Larry Roberts knew Frank Hart. The two had worked together at Lincoln Lab, and Roberts had shared an office with Hart's wife, Jane, a programmer at Lincoln. Roberts and Hart had never worked together directly, but Roberts knew Hart to be an exacting systems engineer. He was an expert in real-time systems, built for when the physical world demands a response within fractions of seconds, or at least before the next set of data arrives. Anything dealing with incoming information in a time-critical fashion, such as radar tracking data sent to the SAGE system, and seismic information generated during an earthquake was considered a real-time system, and in the 1960s, few people understood real-time systems as well as Hart did. Roberts also knew that Hart and Clark were good friends from Lincoln, where Hart had shown Clark the ropes of programming more than a decade earlier. Now, as far as Roberts knew, Hart was at Bolt, Beranek & Newman in Cambridge, where he had moved in 1966 to work on the use of computers in medicine. The ARPA network wasn't intended as a real-time system, not in the same sense of the word that true real-timers understand it. Anything that takes more than 10 to 20 milliseconds, the point at which delays become humanly perceptible, is not considered real-time. Strictly speaking, the ARPA network was to be a store-and-forward system. But data would zip in and out of the node so quickly, and the response time from a human perspective would be so rapid, that it qualified as a real-time problem. The system would have to cope with dozens of problems involving closely sequenced events and extremely tight timing. The status of the network would change constantly, and whoever programmed the computers that composed Clark's proposed subnet would need to know how to make the system handle incoming and outgoing data reliably at very fast rates. Despite the logic of Clark's recommendation, however, Roberts couldn't simply turn the job over to Hart. ARPA had to play by the government's contracting rules. Over the years, most proposals requesting funding arrived at ARPA unsolicited. Seldom had the agency actually requested proposals. But this one was different. The agency had come up with the network idea internally, and in that respect it was also unusual. Also, because the network would be government property controlled centrally by ARPA, and wouldn't reside on one campus, say, or at one research firm, Roberts and others decided they had to send this project out for competitive bids. When he returned to Washington, Roberts wrote a memorandum describing Clark's idea and distributed it to Kleinrock and others. He called the intermediate computers that would control the network Interface Message Processors, or IMPs, which he pronounced IMPs. They were to perform the functions of interconnecting the network, sending and receiving data, checking for errors, retransmitting in the event of errors, routing data, and verifying that messages arrived at their intended destinations. A protocol would be established for defining just how the IMPs should communicate with host computers. After word of Clark's idea spread, the initial hostility toward the network diminished a bit. For one thing, a separate computer to carry out the switching functions removed the burdensome kludge – a kludge is an inelegant solution to a technical problem – that could result from adding those functions to the host computer. People also saw it as a way of getting another computer to play with. At the end of 1967, another computer conference, this one in Gatlinburg, Tennessee, helped advance the network plan. This symposium was sponsored by the Association for Computing Machinery, the oldest and most prestigious of professional organizations for the growing computer industry. Though small in number, the attendees represented the highest levels of the computer science establishment. Gatlinburg was a perfect venue for Roberts to present his first paper on what he called the ARPANET. In his presentation, Roberts focused on the reasons for the network and described the subnet of IMPs, but said little else about how the network would actually work. One big puzzle still to solve was the question of how the data would actually be transmitted, over what kind of channel. Ever mindful of cost, Roberts closed his presentation with a brief discussion of what he called communication needs. He was thinking of using the same type of telephone lines that he and Merrill had used for their small TX2 experiment, full-duplex, four-wire lines. Talk of the matter ended on a note of frustration. Ordinary dial-up phone lines, as opposed to dedicated leased lines, were slow, and holding a line open was wasteful. Robert still hadn't found a highly efficient means of carrying the data. Whereas the Ann Arbor meeting months earlier had been the intellectual equivalent of a barroom brawl, Gatlinburg was high tea. People were politely coming around to the idea of a network. Roberts's presentation was generally well received, even greeted enthusiastically by some. Another paper was presented by Roger Scantlebury. It came from Donald Davies' team at the National Physical Laboratory and discussed the work going on in England. His paper presented a detailed design study for a packet switch network. It was the first Roberts had heard of it. Afterward, Roberts and a few others approached Scantlebury, and they began to discuss the NPL work. The discussion continued at the hotel bar and went late into the night. Scantlebury raised the issue of line speed with Roberts. He said that he and Davies were planning to use lines that operated much faster than the 2,000 bits per second speed Roberts was proposing. He suggested Roberts build the ARPA network with fewer lines carrying data at speeds more than 20 times higher to improve the response time. Roberts also learned from Scantlebury for the first time of the work that had been done by Paul Barron at RAND a few years earlier. When Roberts returned to Washington, he found the RAND reports, which had actually been collecting dust in the Information Processing Techniques office for months, and studied them. Roberts was designing this experimental network not with survivable communications as his main or even secondary concern. Nuclear war scenarios and command and control issues weren't high on Roberts's agenda. But Barron's insights into data communications intrigued him nonetheless, and in early 1968 he met with Barron. After that, Barron became something of an informal consultant to the group Roberts assembled to design the network. The Gatlinburg paper presented by Scantlebury on behalf of the British effort was clearly an influence too. When he visited Roberts during the design of the ARPA network, Davies said, "I saw that our paper had been used so much that its pages were falling apart." Roberts thought the network should start out with four sites: UCLA, SRI, the University of Utah, and the University of California at Santa Barbara, and eventually grow to around 19. UCLA was chosen as the first site because Len Kleinrock's Network Measurement Center was there. At each of the other sites, ARPA-sponsored research that would provide valuable resources to the network was already underway. Researchers at UCSB were working on interactive graphics. Utah researchers were also doing a lot of graphics work, as well as investigating night vision for the military. Dave Evans, who, with Ivan Sutherland, later started Evans and Sutherland, a pioneering graphics company, was at Utah, putting together a system that would take images and manipulate them with a computer. Evans and his group were also interested in whether the network could be used for more than just textual exchanges. Stanford Research Institute, later it severed its ties to Stanford and became just SRI, had been chosen as one of the first sites because Doug Engelbart, a scientist of extraordinary vision, worked there. Several years earlier, when Bob Taylor was at NASA, he had funded Engelbart's invention of the first computer mouse. Engelbart received a patent for the device as an XY position indicator for a display system, and for years afterward Taylor pointed with pride to his support of Engelbart's mouse. Engelbart had been in attendance at the 1967 Ann Arbor meeting of ARPA's principal investigators when Taylor and Larry Roberts announced that a dozen or so of them would be expected to tie their computers together over an experimental network, and that each site would be expected to make its computer resources available on the network. While others had responded skeptically to the plan, Engelbart had been delighted with it. At the time, he was directing an SRI computer research lab. Not unlike Licklider, Engelbart was interested in using computers to augment human intellect. Under a contract from ARPA, he was developing a system, called NLS for Online System, that depended on computer-literate communities. He saw the ARPA experimental network as an excellent vehicle for extending NLS to a wide area of distributed collaboration. "I realized there was a ready-made computer community," Engelbart recalled. "It was just the thing I was looking for." Part of the strength of NLS was its usefulness in creating digital libraries and in storing and retrieving electronic documents. Engelbart also saw NLS as a natural way to support an information clearinghouse for the ARPA network. After all, if people were going to share resources, it was important to let everyone know what was available. At the Michigan meeting, Engelbart volunteered to put together the Network Information Center, which came to be known as the NIC, pronounced NIC. Engelbart also knew that his research group back home in Menlo Park would be equally enthusiastic about the network. His colleagues were talented programmers who would recognize an interesting project when they saw it. The conversation with Scandalberry had clarified several points for Roberts. The Briton's comments about packet switching in particular helped steer Roberts closer to a detailed design. In specifying the network requirements, Roberts was guided by a few basic principles. First, the IMP subnet was to function as a communication system, whose essential task was to transfer bits reliably from a source location to a specified destination. Next, the average transit time through the subnet should be less than half a second. Third, the subnet must be able to operate autonomously. Computers of that era typically required several hours per week of maintenance downtime. IMPs could not afford to be dependent on a local host computer or host site personnel. They should be able to continue operating and routing network traffic whether or not a host was running. The subnetwork also had to continue functioning when individual IMPs were down for service. This idea that maintaining reliability should be incumbent on the subnetwork, not the hosts, was a key principle. Roberts and others believed the IMPs should also attend to such tasks as route selection and acknowledgement of receipt. By the end of July 1968, Roberts had finished drafting the request for proposals. He sent it out to 140 companies interested in building the interface message processor. The document was thick with details of what the network should look like and what the IMP would be expected to do. It was a rich piece of technical prose, filled with an eclectic mix of ideas. Kleinrock had influenced Roberts' earliest thoughts about the theoretical possibilities. Barron had contributed to the intellectual foundation on which the technical concept was based. And Roberts' dynamic routing scheme gave an extra nod to Barron's work. Roberts had adopted Davies' term packet and incorporated his and Scantleberry's higher line speeds. Clark's subnet idea was a stroke of technical genius. "The process of technological development is like building a cathedral," remarked Barron years later. "Over the course of several hundred years, new people come along and each lays down a block on top of the old foundations, each saying, 'I built a cathedral.' Next month, another block is placed atop the previous one. Then comes along an historian who asks, 'Well, who built the cathedral? Peter added some stones here, and Paul added a few more.' If you are not careful, you can con yourself into believing that you did the most important part. But the reality is that each contribution has to follow onto previous work. Everything is tied to everything else." But in 1968, the network's principal architect was Larry Roberts. He made the initial decisions, and he established the parameters and operational specifications. Although he would get input from others, Roberts would be the one to decide who built it. The first responses to the request for proposals were from IBM and Control Data Corporation, CDC. IBM was then the world's largest computer manufacturer and dominated the market for large computer systems. CDC, though dwarfed by IBM, was another company that had invested heavily in developing large systems. Both declined to bid, and their reasons were identical. The network could never be built, they said flatly, because there existed no computer small enough to make it cost-effective. For the IMP, IBM had thought about proposing a 360 Model 50 computer, a large mainframe. But at a price many times that of a minicomputer, the Model 50 was too expensive to consider buying in large quantities. Roberts, on the other hand, was thinking small. The first computer he had thought of was the PDP-8, a minicomputer made by Digital Equipment Corporation. Digital had released the PDP-8 in 1965. Not only was it the company's first big hit, but the PDP-9 also established minicomputers as the new vanguard of the computer industry. Roberts knew Ken Olson from Lincoln, and he thought Digital might even offer a quantity discount on the machine. When bids started coming in, the majority had chosen a Honeywell computer instead. It was a mini-computer called the DDP-516. Honeywell had just introduced it. Part of the new machine's cachet was that it could be built to heavy-duty specifications. In its ruggedized version, it cost about $80,000. Shortly after the machine's introduction at a computer conference in Las Vegas, the hardened military version was hoisted off the showroom floor by a crane. As it swung from ropes attached to the crane, a Honeywell employee took a sledgehammer to it. The point of the exercise was to demonstrate that the machine was tough enough to operate on a battlefield. For bidders, the more likely appeal of the 516 was its impressive cost-performance ratio and the design of its input-output system. More than a dozen bids were submitted, resulting in a 6-foot stack of paper. Merrill's company, CCA, bid jointly with Digital. Raytheon bid, and so did Bunker Ramo. Roberts was pleasantly surprised that several of the respondents believed they could construct a network that performed faster than the goal listed in the specifications. Raytheon was a frontrunner. A major defense contractor in the Boston area specializing in electronic systems components, Raytheon had already proposed to build a high-speed, short-distance computer network. In the middle of December, Roberts entered into final negotiations with Raytheon for the IMP contract. Raytheon officials answered ARPA's remaining technical questions and accepted the price. So, it surprised everyone when, just a few days before Christmas, ARPA announced that the contract to build the interface message processors that would reside at the core of its experimental network was being awarded to Bolt, Baranek & Newman, a small consulting firm in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Chapter 3. The Third University. When Richard Bolt and Leo Baranek started their consulting company in 1948, advanced computing was not on their minds. Baranek was an electrical engineer, Bolt an architect and physicist. Both were acousticians and members of the MIT faculty during the 1940s. Bolt had worked for the Navy in World War II on methods for using sound to detect submarines. Following the war, as head of MIT's acoustics laboratory, Bolt did consulting work, as did Baranek. MIT began receiving requests for aid in acoustical planning for new buildings around the country, and passed them on to Bolt and Baranek. Independently of each other, the two had already done quite a bit of work in what is known as airborne acoustics, the sound carried in concert halls and movie theaters, as well as in noise control and noise reduction in buildings. When the United Nations asked Bolt to design the acoustics for its new complex of buildings in an old slaughterhouse district on Manhattan's East River, Bolt called Baranek into his office and showed him the pile of papers spelling out the UN job. It was too much for one person to take on. At the time, Baranek was busy on a project to improve the acoustics in a chain of Brooklyn movie theaters. But Bolt convinced Baranek to join him in starting a consulting firm to take on the UN project. A year later, they took in Robert Newman, an architect with a physics background who had been a student of Bolt's, and Bolt, Baranek, and Newman was born. In its earliest days, BBN was truly a consulting company. That is, Bolt and Baranek hired people, provided them with office space, and expected them to find the work. And find work they did. The UN project was such a conspicuous success that the company didn't need to advertise for the first 10 years of its existence. The business grew as BBN consulted on the design of acoustical systems for office buildings, apartment complexes, and performing arts centers. When a large wind tunnel was built for testing jet engines near Cleveland, the noise disturbed people within a 10-mile radius, and local residents threatened to have the facility shut down. BBN engineers figured out a way to muffle the sound. The company was developing expertise in analyzing audio tapes. It was called in after the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in 1963, and would be called on again after the shootings at Kent State University in 1970. Its most famous tape analysis would come during the Watergate scandal in 1974, when BBN would be involved in the analysis of the infamous 18-and-a-half-minute gap in the Nixon tapes. A committee headed by Dick Bolt would conclude that the erasure was deliberate. In 1957, Baranek had recruited Licklider to BBN. He had worked with Lick at Harvard during the war, and when he went to MIT, he convinced Lick to go there too. When Baranek hired Lick at BBN, it wasn't so much Lick's background in psychoacoustics, but his interest in human-machine interaction that Baranek thought was interesting. Baranek sensed that consulting jobs would pick up in the business of helping companies build machines that were more efficient amplifiers of human labor, which meant bringing about some kind of compatibility between humans and machines. "I don't know how big a business it was," Baranek later recalled, "but I thought it was a good supplement to what we were doing." Lick, of course, had thought it through more fully. He believed the future of scientific research was going to be linked to high-speed computers, and he thought computing was a good field for BBN to enter. He had been at BBN for less than a year when he told Baranek he'd like to buy a computer. By way of persuasion, Lick stressed that the computer he had in mind was a very modern machine. Its programs and data were punched on paper tape rather than the conventional stacks of IBM cards. "What will it cost?" Baranek asked him. "Around $25,000. "That's a lot of money," Baranek replied. "What are you going to do with it?" "I don't know." Licklider was convinced the company would be able to get contracts from the government to do basic research using computers. The $25,000, he assured Baranek, wouldn't be wasted. None of the company's three principals knew much about computers. Baranek knew that Lick, by contrast, was almost evangelistic in his belief that computers would change not only the way people thought about problems, but the way problems were solved. Baranek's faith in Licklider won the day. "I decided it was worth the risk to spend $25,000 on an unknown machine for an unknown purpose," Baranek said. The computer he purchased for Lick was an LG P30, manufactured in 1958 by Royal McBee, a subsidiary of the Royal Typewriter Company. It had a drum memory and was slow even by the standards of its day. Yet Lick went straight to work tinkering with it, using it for lengthy statistical calculations and psychoacoustics experiments. Not long after the computer arrived, Ken Olson stopped by to see the Royal McBee machine and to tell BBN about the computer he was building at his new company, Digital Equipment. Olson wanted to lend Baranek a prototype of the machine, which he called the PDP-1, so BBN engineers could take a look at it. Baranek agreed, but the computer measured 4 feet by 8 feet, and there were few doorways at BBN through which to squeeze it. So it was set up in the lobby. A month or so later, after everyone had a chance to play with it, BBN sent it back to Olson with recommendations for fine-tuning. When the PDP-1 went on the market for slightly less than $150,000, BBN bought the first one. The presence of the PDP-1 and the work Licklider was doing with it attracted a number of leading computer scientists to BBN. The firm had also become well known as a place whose hiring philosophy was to recruit MIT dropouts. The idea was that if they could get into MIT, they were smart, and if they dropped out, you could get them cheaper. Baranek gave Lick a great deal of freedom to hire whomever he pleased, and Licklider did just that, occasionally forgetting to tell Baranek. "I was wandering around the building one day to see what was going on in the computer side, and I saw two strange guys sitting in one of the large rooms there," Baranek said. Lick would have been happy to wear a suit to a picnic, but his hirees were decidedly less formal. Baranek had no idea who the two men were. "I walked up to the first fellow and said, 'Who are you?' And he said, 'Who are you?' And the two young men, it turned out, were friends of Licklider's from MIT, Marvin Minsky and John McCarthy, two of the most prominent figures in the emerging field of artificial intelligence." The PDP-1 had computing power roughly equivalent to today's pocket organizers, and a little less memory. People at BBN kept the computer going day and night doing interactive programming. They even built a time-sharing system around it, dividing the screen for four simultaneous users. The time-sharing demonstration was a success, and BBN decided to start a time-sharing service in the Boston area by placing terminals throughout the city. Soon, however, General Electric mounted a similar effort and quickly stole the bulk of BBN's time-sharing business. The presence of an accessible computer inspired a change in the company. Everyone began thinking of things that could be done with it. One BBN scientist, Jordan Baruch, decided hospitals could use computers to keep more accurate information on patients, so he set out to computerize the record handling at Massachusetts General Hospital. Lick and others began exploring ways in which computers could transform libraries. But computers in the early 1960s were still too underpowered to do much. By this time, BBN had begun to concentrate seriously on computer technology. The richly academic atmosphere at BBN earned the consulting firm a reputation as the third university in Cambridge. "I had the policy that every person we hired had to be better than the previous people," said Baranek. Next to MIT and Harvard, BBN became one of the most attractive places to work in the Boston area. Some people even considered it better than the universities, because there was no teaching obligation and no worry over earning tenure. It was a rarefied environment, the cognac of the research business. The firm's architectural acoustics division went through a crisis in the early 1960s, when Baranek was hired to design the acoustics for the new Philharmonic Hall, later renamed Avery Fisher Hall, at New York's Lincoln Center. Both Baranek and the chief architect were criticized.